Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Our topic today is how to create new jobs for real with Dr. Walter Block. Welcome, Walter.
Thanks, Michael. I'm delighted to be on your show.
Well, we're at Radio Free Market. We're delighted to have you back again. So everyone, I want you all to be reminded that Dr. Block is a professor of economics at Loyola University in New Orleans. He is a senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute, the author of Defending the Undefendable, and recently was given the title of Mr. Libertarian. And I think that is far too modest a way of introducing you, but we don't really have time to present all of all of your background, Walter.
Well, I don't think it's far too modest. I think it's far too the opposite, because Murray Rothbard was called that, and I don't know that I deserve to be called the same thing as Murray, but thanks in any case.
Well, it wasn't me that, as you know, it wasn't me that came up with that. That was Lou Rockwell that actually decided that you should be given that particular title. So, everyone, we also have Mr. Aaron Brown with us today, and I want to welcome Aaron. Hello.
Hello. Glad to be back.
All right, great. So, everyone, Aaron Brown attends the University of San Diego Business School and is a 2010 graduate of Mises University. And I want to credit Aaron for not only being our special commentator today, but also for being the chief architect for this show, and the reason that we actually are having this show today. You know, I consider this topic of how to create new jobs for real and the whole discussion about jobs as one of the most foundational topics, and this to be one of the most foundational shows that we will do here at Radio Free Market. And I'm going to encourage our listeners to listen to this show more than once, to take notes, to generously share it with your friends and family and everyone you care about. So now I'd like to hand the show over to get started to Mr. Aaron Brown. Go ahead, Aaron.
Okay, so today's show, it's based on an article that Dr. Block wrote. It's called A Primer on Jobs and the Jobless, and it's on Mises.org. It's dated March 9th of 2004. And so our objective today is just to cut through the kind of the impenetrable facade of the jobs question. And our show for the audience is just how do we create new jobs, meaningful jobs. So I think it's useful to begin the conversation, just ask ourselves, what are new jobs good for? What purpose do they serve? So I wanted to ask you, Walter, are jobs desirable per se in and of themselves?
Well, I follow Hazlitt on this, and really jobs are not desirable per se. They're only desirable because of the things that jobs make available, namely goods and services. If we had, if we were living in, nirvana, and manna came down from the heavens in the form of whatever we wanted. You know, you want a Maserati, you get a Maserati. You want a Rolls Royce, you sort of look at the manna, and it turns into a Rolls Royce. Then we wouldn't need jobs. Unfortunately, we don't live in any such situation. We live in the real world, and in the real world, we have this thing called scarcity, which means that we have more desires than things that we have. So we have to work for the things that we want that we don't have. I mean, happily, we have some things like air and other good things, but there are a lot of things that we want that we don't have, and that's why we have to have jobs. So jobs are important as a means toward the end of goods and services, but they're not good intrinsically themselves.
Okay. Now, unfortunately, this first segment is already coming to a very rapid ending. And so before we get into our next question, Walter, what we'll do is we'll take a brief commercial break. And when we come back, folks, we're going to continue with Dr. Walter Block on our conversation of how to create new jobs for real. And so please stay with us. This is Radio Free Market. I'm your host, Michael McKay, and we'll be back in just a minute. Please stay with us. And welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market. We're talking with Dr. Walter Block on jobs. And so I would like to ask Aaron Brown to continue the conversation we were just having. Go ahead, Aaron.
Yeah, so I asked Dr. Block if jobs are desirable in themselves. And I remember Peter Schiff said one time, said the purpose of the economy is it's not to create jobs, it's really to eliminate jobs. It's to make the economy so productive that people don't have to work so often. And in your article, you wrote, Dr. Block, that, you know, were jobs in the Soviet Union desirable, where millions of workers were just building things that no one wanted? In that case, jobs are obviously not desirable.
Yes, quite right. Jobs are a means to an end, and the end is things we want. And if the jobs are making things that we don't want, well, then let's say the Keynesian thing of digging holes and filling them up again, then that's silly. I mean, what's the point of working to dig a hole and then fill it up again and keep doing it endlessly when no one really wants a filled-in hole? You know, we want maybe a hole that we can put a building in or something like that. So I think Peter Schiff is quite right in saying that we want jobs, not any old jobs, but jobs that produce things that we want.
You know, at this particular point, I think for me, when I've heard you lecture on this topic before, really brings it out that you really say that the whole focus is on the wrong word. It's not. It shouldn't be on the word jobs. It should be on the word production. Would you comment more on that?
Oh, yes, I entirely agree. The key is that we want goods and services. We want food. We want clothing. We want shelter. We want health care. We want, violin lessons and all sorts of things. And that's the focus on productivity. And Hazlitt and Peter Schiff and others, Rothbard, Mises, have made this point very tellingly, that a job is a bad thing. It's a necessary evil, but it's an evil. Nobody really wants a job per se. Now, there is such a thing called play. Like, for example, the people who are now playing in the National Football League, I assume they enjoy doing what they're doing, and they get paid very well for it. So ideally, the key would be that everyone doesn't work at their job, but plays at their job. So all jobs are play jobs. Namely, we all enjoy what we're doing. I'm no National Football League person, but I'm a professor of economics, and I tell you, I love the job. Don't tell my dean, because he'll try to lower my salary, but I really love my job. I get to lecture to very bright young undergraduates and tell them that free enterprise is great. And in effect, I'm really playing for my pay. So I and football players and athletes and I imagine actors and other people and lawyers and accountants and whoever enjoys their job are really playing for pay, and those are the kinds of jobs we want to have.
Okay. Now, Aaron, you were and I were talking about this, and you had an example related to General Motors.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, we were all told by the government and the media that, you know, if GM was allowed to go bankrupt, then thousands of people would lose their jobs. But I'm guessing that your objection to that would be, well, were those jobs creating a product that people in fact wanted?
Well, you know, we can't really call them General Motors anymore. I think we have to now call them GM Government Motors, because they've been really nationalized. And my understanding is that these guys were getting like 75, 80 bucks per hour when you
right.
include their fringe benefits.
Right.
Now, you know, I'm not going to cast aspersions on GM products, but the point is that not only do we have to create things that people want, but we have to create things that people want at less cost than they value it at. In other words, if we value a car at $5,000 and it costs $10,000 to make that car, then that's not a good job. And in the free enterprise system, what would have happened is that these people would have lost their jobs happily, because they were taken over by unions, and I regard unions as some sort of gigantic tapeworm that just sucks out the nutrients from the host. These people would have gone unemployed, and then they might have been picked up by, I don't know, Toyota or Honda or other automobile manufacturers who pay not $75 or $80 an hour, but, oh, $20, $30 an hour. And they're located mainly in the South, which is non-union territory. So it's not that these people would have been permanently unemployed. They would have been saved from the tapeworm of unionism, and they would have got jobs at salaries that are more congruent with their productivity levels, whereas now they were paying way more than their productivity levels. I assume their productivity levels are something like $20 or $30 an hour. But if they're paid much more than that, there's only one way to go, and that's that the company that's employing them is going to lose money and go broke. And the only way they can stay in business is if the government supports them. But this is very bad. It's as if instead of paying them to dig holes and fill them up again, we're paying them to produce, let's say, good cars for the sake of argument, but at twice the cost of the value that we place on those cars. So not only do they does a job have to produce stuff that we want, but it has to produce stuff that we want at a price that is fitting with the value that we place on it.
You know, so for our listening audience, I want to clarify something. These first few questions are the foundation for wanting to know what is going on in the jobs market. We want to make sure that everyone is asking the right questions that get at the root of what creates prosperity. So to finish off these introductory remarks and questions, I want to read a quote from the article that you wrote, Dr. Block, and how it captures the core issue perfectly, in my opinion. You write, "Imagine a world where radios, pizzas, jogging shoes, and everything else we might want continuously rain down like manna from heaven. Would we want jobs in such a utopia? No, we would devote ourselves to other tasks, basking in the sun, etc., that we would undertake for their intrinsic pleasure. Instead of praising jobs for their own sake, we should ask why employment is so important. The answer is because we exist amidst economic scarcity and must work to live and prosper. That's why we should be of good cheer only when we learn that this employment will produce things people actually value, are willing to buy with their own hard-earned money. And this is something that can only be done in a free market, not by bureaucrats and politicians." That's the end of your quote. Now, I know that that summarizes and actually reiterates some of the things and comments that you made earlier, but when we were crafting this show, we thought that the way you phrased that particular statement was so vitally important, we wanted to reiterate it even if you did say it earlier. So thank you very much for that. And Aaron, I'm going to let you just, you know, leap forward onto the next topic while we still have time in this segment. Go ahead.
All right. So, with that frame of mind, we want to begin the meat of the article, and you laid out a couple of points. And you started with the minimum wage. And I think we're all kind of taught to believe that the minimum wage is kind of a, you know, it's, I actually had one of my friends say, we've chosen to live in a society where we have a certain minimum standard of living, and that's why we have the minimum wage. So first I want to define what it is. The minimum wage, for our listeners, is a government law that forces business people to pay their employees no less than a certain wage. And if you're caught paying less than that, the government will either fine you or force your business to close. And again, Walter, we're told that the minimum wage helps the economy, and specifically poor people. It helps poor people, right? That's what we're told. How does the minimum wage hurt those very poor people that it's supposed to help?
Well, the minimum wage, most people think of, when they think of the minimum wage, they think of it as a floor under wages, and the higher you push it, the higher wages get pushed. So if we have a minimum wage of $4 an hour, no one can go below the floor of $4 an hour, but that's pretty niggardly, so let's raise it to $5 an hour. Now we raise the minimum wage to $5 an hour, and everyone gets paid $5 an hour. Isn't that great? But wait, we can raise it to 6 and 7. I think it's now 7 and change. So the higher we raise it, the higher wages are at the low end of the income job pyramid. That is the erroneous theory. The correct theory is that jobs are minimum wage is more like a hurdle over which you have to jump in order to get a job in the first place. Mm-hmm. So if the minimum wage law is $5 an hour and your productivity is $4 an hour, well, then anyone who hires you at $5 an hour when you're only adding to their bottom line $4 an hour, it's going to cost you, the employer, $1 an hour. And if you hire people like that, you're going to lose money. And if you hire too many like that, you're going to go broke. So
right.
The minimum wage law is really not a law that raises wages. It's a law that cuts off people whose productivity is below the minimum wage level. Now, one easy way to see this is suppose, you know, if it were really true that the minimum wage law could raise wages, why stop at $5, $6, $7, $8 an hour, $10 an hour? Why not make it $1,000 an hour? Why not have a minimum wage law for $1,000 an hour, and then everyone will make $1,000 an hour, and wouldn't that be great?
Right.
Well, the proponents of minimum wage law never follow the logic of their argument, because if we had a minimum wage law of $1,000 an hour, and the only people who have $1,000 an hour productivity in them are people like, I don't know, Tom Cruise or Nadal, the tennis player, most of us, virtually all of us, would be unemployed, because we're just not worth $1,000 an hour. Our productivity is not $1,000 an hour. If our productivity were $100 an hour, and that's pretty good, you have to be pretty good to have $100 an hour productivity, and the employer was forced to pay you $1,000 an hour, he'd lose $900 an hour on you, and that's not a viable situation.
So we're going to talk more about this issue of minimum wage, because I think this is a fundamental issue also that most people have a very incorrect understanding of. And I thank you very much for bringing out these points, Dr. Block. So we'll get a bit more into this when we come back from our break. So everyone, please stay with us. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay. We're talking with Dr. Walter Block about how to create new jobs for real. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. And welcome back, everyone. So, Dr. Block, before the break, we were talking about the minimum wage and how it hurts the very people that it's supposed to help. You gave the analogy of, let's say, a minority worker or a young person as being like a porcupine, and that the minimum wage harms these minorities in the same way that removing the porcupine's quills harms the porcupine. You know, I think this is a very instructive example that you've presented in some of your literature. And can you share a bit more of that with us?
Yes, there are certain animals, like the porcupine, that would be very helpless without their quills. Other animals that would be helpless without their compensating differential. The deer has fleetness of foot. Otherwise, if it was slow, it would be slaughtered. The skunk has... Well, you can imagine what the skunk has, but if it didn't have that smell, it too would be a victim. Well, what does a minority teenage worker have? What ability does he have in order to get a job when people are suspicious of him or maybe even prejudiced against him? What he has is the ability, in the free market that is, to work for a lower wage. So if there were an employer who was looking askance at this, say, young black teenage worker, and saying, well, do I really want to give this kid a chance? If the kid could come up and say, look, like a Horatio Alger type of story, look, give me a dollar an hour, a stinking lousy dollar an hour. Let me work for you. I'll work for you for a week for a dollar an hour, and I'll show you that my productivity is, $5, $6, $8, $10 an hour. And after the week, you know, you can raise my wage if you want to keep me, because, you know, if I'm really going to add to your bottom line and only take a dollar an hour, it's to your advantage. And I think that having this ability to say this would help a young kid get a job where the employer might not give him the job. But with the minimum wage law, it would be illegal for the employer to go along with that. If he paid the kid a dollar an hour just to give him a chance, he'd go to jail for it, or he'd be fined, or he'd be forced to shut down.
Mm-hmm.
So what the minimum wage law does is takes away the ability of a weak economic actor, akin to a weak animal without the quills or the smell or the fleetness of foot. And this is very very despicable to pick on the lowest members of society or the economy, people who have the lowest productivity. Now, you might ask, well, why if the minimum wage law is so lousy, if it's taking away the ability of workers to offer employers this this sort of a deal to work for a low wage just as a trial period. Well, why do we have the bloody law in the first place? And the answer to that is one of my least favorite institutions, second to government perhaps, is unions. See, when a union goes to the employer and says, look, we're making $20 an hour, we need 25, the first thing that the employer thinks of is, well, let me fire a few of these high-priced workers and hire a few dozen low-wage workers, and then, you know, the skilled workers can be sort of foremen for the unskilled workers. But the last thing that the union wants is for the employer to start looking for low-skilled alternatives, and they call them scabs, and they used to beat them up. But now they're much more sophisticated, and they've come up with a law, the minimum wage law, which cuts this off at the root. It doesn't enable the employer to start firing union workers, high-paid skilled workers, and start hiring many more unskilled workers to take their place.
So you're saying when we look at this logically, the minimum wage actually, it creates a semi-permanent sector of unemployment, and it harms really the whole of society, but particularly weak economic actors.
Precisely. The unemployment rate for overall is 9.6, 9.7, something like that. According to the shadow statistics, which I think are much more accurate, the overall employment rate for society is something like 19 or 20%. I might be a bit
actually,
off.
Actually, it just went over 22%.
Oh, 22%. Well, thanks.
Yeah, John, and for our listeners, Dr. Black just referred to something we've encouraged our listeners to look into. This is shadowstats.com, and it's run by a gentleman by the name of John Williams, and I encourage you to go to his website at shadowstats.com and download some of the free data that he has, and it outlines how the government has systematically changed the accounting procedures over the last 40 years so that what we are actually looking at in statistics that we see reported are not actually the same kind of accounting methodologies that were used back in the 1950s, for example. So they've doctored these various different metrics from labor statistics and inflation and CPI and so on and so forth. It's an invaluable site. I recommend everyone to look into it. So I'm sorry I interrupted Aaron and Walter. Please go ahead.
No. That's quite a very important contribution. I hadn't looked at that for a while, so I was a little outdated. I thought it was 19 or 20%. I'm happy to be corrected that it's 22%. But the unemployment rate for male black teens is 50%, 5-0, not 1-5, but 5-0.
Gosh.
50%, which is horrendous. And I think a lot of that is due to the minimum wage law, and it might conceivably even be higher when you take into fact the phenomenon called the discouraged worker phenomenon. And this is the point is that the way the government counts unemployment is you have to be actively looking for a job. But if you've been actively looking for a job and not finding one for a year or so, and the duration of unemployment, even for adult workers, is now very high in our present depression recession. So if you're discouraged and you're not even looking for a job, then by the magic of statistical lies, you're no longer unemployed. So the real unemployment rate, when you take this into account, is perhaps even higher.
Okay, Walter, I'm going to have to interrupt you. We're going to come into our next break. So everyone, please stay with us, and we'll be back in just a minute. This is Radio Free Market, and we'll be back right after the break.
Okay, and we're back on Radio Free Market with Dr. Walter Block. So, Walter, in past shows, we've delved into the topic of how government kind of tinkering with the economy, it causes changes in people's behavior and influences how they act. In your article, you write of how the minimum wage, it causes unemployment, which we've discussed before the break, but it also causes dependency. It causes loneliness and isolation, and that was kind of a striking comment to me. How does this happen? How does unemployment cause dependency and isolation?
Well, I mean, if you're unemployed, a lot of people, their self-image, and I'm no sociologist or psychologist, but I think a lot of people's self-image is tied up in their job. I tell you, there were times in my own life when I was unemployed, and I wasn't a happy camper about that. You know, the money wasn't coming in, and I have dependents that are dependent upon me to bring the money in. You know, so I was sort of not very happy when I was unemployed, and I assume that when other people are unemployed and want a job and can't find it, that their you know, their self-esteem goes down, or their general level of happiness goes down. They sort of feel like a fish out of water. So I can't imagine that this would be good for people, not only economically, because the money isn't coming in, but socially or psychologically or in any other way.
You know, another example that you give, and I love this example, is the government mandating the salaries of truck drivers and nurses being the same. You know, most people would look at government-mandated pay raise for nurses to the same level as truck drivers as a good thing, especially since women are such a large, you know, segment of the profession. But how does this government-mandated pay raise actually harm the very women it's supposed to help?
Well, just like the minimum wage, if ever you raise wages above productivity levels, for whatever reason, whether it's minimum wage or equal pay for equal work or a desire to stamp down on sexual discrimination, if you raise people's wages above market levels, above the levels that are congruent with their productivity, well, then you unemploy them. Happily, this government initiative has not really got legs under it. It hasn't really taken fold. Female unemployment rates are roughly the same as male unemployment rates. But if this ever did get into effect, then it would. Now, you see, the reason for it, women earn on average about 70% of what men earn, and the thought is that women are just as productive as men nowadays. And I agree. I think on average women and men are roughly equally productive. In past centuries, when a lot of jobs took upper body strength, like knocking down trees with a hatchet or pushing a bale or lifting lifting a bale, pushing something or other, a barge, then men's productivity was higher than women's. But nowadays, the way we do heavy work is mostly with steam shovels and trucks and things like that, and women are roughly as capable as are men of pushing buttons and levers and turning a steering wheel on a big truck.
Mm-hmm.
So why then are women earning less than men, and why is it that the progressives, the liberals, the do-gooders, the semi-socialists, why are they trying to push women's wages up? Well, because they think it's unfair, and it's due to the innate discriminatory essence of capitalism. The real reason, though, is very different. The real reason is because women aren't as connected to the labor force as are men. Women have lower productivity in the market because they have an unequal and much higher share of household work, cooking, cleaning, taking care of kids, getting up at night when the kid is sick, things like that. Women do much more of that than men. And whenever you do anything, it's always at the cost of something else. For example, LeBron James, I posit, is not a world-class cello player. Why? Well, in order to be a world-class cello player, you've got to play the cello 6, 8, 10 hours a day. And LeBron James is a basketball player, and he's not playing the cello 6, 8, 10 hours a day, so he's not a good cello player, even though he might be if he put his mind and his fingers to the cello. Well, women, instead of playing basketball, they're taking care of kids. And whenever you do any one thing, you have to do other things less well than you could have done had you not been doing the first thing. So if women are doing the lion's share of house cleaning and cooking and child care, well, then something's got to give, and it's cello playing and productivity in the market. That's why they make less money. The point is that if women and men were equally productive and women were paid $7 for every $10 an hour that men were paid, this would represent a gigantic profit opportunity for employers. It would be as if every woman had a little lapel pin saying, hire me and you make an extra $3 an hour off of my work. That would not be an equilibrium situation. And when you look at the statistics, the 70% is an amalgam of the never-marrieds and the ever-marrieds. And if you look at never-married male and female, never-married means not widowed, not divorced, not separated, not married, not anything, there is no wage gap. There's no wage gap between never-married men and never-married women. But there's a much bigger than 30% wage gap between ever-married men and women. And that is, so this is sort of an indication as to what's really going on. So you might think that the feminists here are filled with the milk of human kindness and are trying to help women who are despised by the market. But they're not despised or trampled on by the market. It's just because they're more into house cleaning and cooking and cleaning and child care.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating presentation there. Aaron, you wanted to bring out this topic of unions, and I know Walter's itching to get into it, so let's go forward with that.
Yeah, so you commented a little bit on it earlier, but I think unions, and it was for me, one of the most difficult issues to understand before I started really studying economics. So briefly, what is a union and how does it work?
Well, a union is a very complicated issue. If there were a union that said, okay, look, we're not going to violate the libertarian axiom of non-aggression, the non-aggression principle, we're going to just do everything according to libertarian theory, then it would be sort of okay. And now, what could a union do if they limited themselves to being compatible with libertarianism? What they could do is they could say something like the following. When one guy goes to the boss and says, hey, boss, I'm making $15 an hour. I need a raise to $20. The boss says, you know, my way or the highway, and fires him. But if all 500 workers agree to have one spokesman go to the boss and say, hey, boss, if you don't give us all a $5 increase from $15 to $20 an hour, we're all going to leave. We're all going to down tools and walk out. Well, now the boss has got to think twice because, you know, it's going to take a little effort to replace 500 people who work on the machine floor, the shop floor, and are coordinated and work together and, you know, are busy producing. And if he tells them all the, you know, my way or the highway, he's going to face a few weeks or months of no productivity, and his stockholders aren't going to be too happy. So there is a legitimate union power. But are there any unions that limit themselves to this? I once did some research on this, and I came up with this, nothing in the U.S., but I came up with this thing called the CLAC, C-L-A-C, Canadian Labor Association of Canada. I think that's not the exact word. Canada wouldn't appear twice, but it was C-L-A-C. And they were a very religious, I think it was Christian Labor Association of Canada. That's it. And I said, well, look, do you limit yourself to just walkouts, or do you threaten scabs? You see, the second thing that the unions do, in addition to saying, well, we're all going to stop working for you, is they're going to say, not only are we going to stop working for you, but we're going to set up picket lines, and the picket lines are going to stop customers from coming in to buy stuff, and it's going to stop suppliers from supplying the raw materials, and also it's going to make sure that you can't hire replacements for us, and we're going to call them scabs, and we're going to beat them up. And the Christian Labor Association of Canada said, oh, no, certainly we're not. We're Christians. We wouldn't do that. And then I said, well, what do you think about labor legislation that forces the employer to deal with you whether he wants to do so or not? And they said, oh, well, we favor labor legislation like that. So even the Christian Labor Association of Canada, which I thought was a pretty good union, bought into this other way of violating the libertarian non-aggression principle, namely they support laws that compel the employer to keep the union or to bargain with him when he wants to get rid of them. He might say, okay, all 500 of you, you're a bunch of bums. I'm going to get replacement workers for you, scabs, as you call them, and, you know, lots of luck or lots of luck. But the CLAC group bought into this. So as far as I'm concerned, there are no legitimate unions, even though theoretically there could be. Okay,
now,
so given that
you wrote,
go ahead.
You wrote that if the government forces businesses to hire only union workers, they create unemployment among non-union workers, which I think seems fairly obvious to most people. But if the unions partner with the government to enforce these union agreements and the union workers benefit by receiving higher wages, then how do the individuals in government benefit?
Well, are you talking about public sector unions now?
Well, actually, what we're looking at, it was kind of a trick question, because basically, you know, it's pretty obvious how the union workers benefit in this whole thing, but because they're really partnering with government, you know, whether they're public sector unions or private sector unions, the the question really is oriented around how the bureaucrats in government actually benefit by coming, or politicians and bureaucrats in government come up, benefit from coming up with and enforcing this kind of arrangement. What is the benefit to the actual government politician, to the government bureaucrat?
Well, in the United States, the Democratic Party, the unions are a wholly owned subsidiary of the Democratic Party. And even the Republicans try to ingratiate themselves with the unions because they're well organized, they have a lot of votes. President Obama now is trying to get rid of this secret ballot for certifying new unions, which is a horror. So I would say that the short answer to your question is that the government bureaucrats and particularly politicians gain because they'll get the union votes and the union donations, and unions will go out and stump for them when there's an election, like in the last election that the Republicans won. The unions were very heavily in favor of the Democrats, giving them lots of money and lots of shoes on the ground, going out and handing out leaflets and activities of that sort.
Walter, you wrote that unions are a state-protected cartel, just like any other, like a banana cartel or a banking cartel. Of course, we don't have any of those, but can you explain this to us, how unions are have the appearance of being a state-protected cartel, or are a state-protected cartel?
Yes, they definitely are, because the Wagner Act and the Taft-Hartley Act and all this other labor legislation has declared certain things to be unfair labor practices. One of them is to refuse to even deal with the union. You have to bargain in good faith with the union. I don't know, it just seems a horrendous thing to me to force people to deal with each other when they don't want to deal with each other. In the libertarian society, all interaction should be strictly on a voluntary basis. So what the government is doing is putting its big fat thumb on one side of the balance and helping unions by forcing employers to deal with them whether they want to or not. See, it's all well and good to refuse to, that the union wants to down tools and walk away from the job. It's sort of like if a man wants to divorce his wife, okay, it's maybe a personal tragedy, but maybe he has a right to do that. But when the man then gets his friends to surround his ex-wife's house, and any time she wants to date someone else, they beat him up, well, that's not good. And that's exactly what the union is doing. They're saying, look, we don't like these jobs. You're stinking lousy jobs. You're not paying us enough, and the working conditions aren't enough. We want better air conditioning. And we're going to walk off the job, and we're going to make sure no one else can take these jobs that we don't want. So it would be like the ex-husband refusing to allow his ex-wife to date other men.
And you know, before we leave this, before we leave this topic about unions, Aaron and I, in our conversations in preparation for the show, we came across quite a bit of information on the public pension time bomb that's coming up. In fact, 60 Minutes this past week, we're taping this show on the 22nd of December, and we're going to actually air this on January 1st, 2011. And this past Sunday, there was a segment on 60 Minutes on how the state and municipal governments are imminently in about to be in default because of the, in large measure, because of the pensions that they have granted to their public employees. And so I'm going to hand this back over to you, Aaron, to develop this this thread. So please go ahead.
Yeah. So for our listeners, if the idea that unions or the unions are a state protected cartel, if that seems just fantastical to you and just completely out of the realm of normal conversation, consider some of these stats that 70% of Decatur, which is a city in Illinois. 70% of their property taxes, so people are forced at gunpoint to pay property taxes, 70% of those taxes are going to go to fund union pensions. And there are a ton of stats I could rattle off, and I won't waste too much time, but I mean, just think about that. 70% of people's taxes that they're forced to pay on their property are going to fund a union pension which uses the coercive power of government to force up their wages. And again, there are a ton of other stats. We're going to move on to licensing, but I encourage you.
I actually, before we leave this topic, I want to mention one other thing, and then I want to get Walter to comment on it. There was one other stat that you uncovered, Aaron, that I thought was very important for everyone to hear about. One of the things that I was not aware of until we were researching this show is that the public sector unions have a more lenient accounting standard than the private sector unions, and that there is an estimate of about $3 trillion in debt in excess of all outstanding state and government bonds. Now, as a result of that, there is new legislation that was introduced December 2nd in the U.S. House of Representatives called the Public Employee Pension Transparency Act. It's just getting started, but this will this is some a development that everyone needs to be aware of. So, Walter, we only have about another minute in this segment, but would you care to comment on this?
Well, you see, the traditional idea of unions was that the capitalist pig is greedy and the government has to help the poor worker. But if the government is such a good guy and only the capitalist is a bad guy, how do you justify public sector unions at all? Because the government is supposed to be the working man's friend. So why should unions be able to strike against government, who is the good guy? Only the profit-seeking capitalist is a bad guy. On the other hand, you know, I said unions were my second least favorite institution, and my first least favorite one is the government. So when a union and a government are fighting, I'm sort of, you know, I say that I don't really have any dog in this fight, sort of a pox on both houses, sort of like Stalin fighting Hitler. I'm not really a friend of the government either.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about this, and we're really coming fast to the end of this segment, is that up into, through the 1970s, private company pensions, unions were actually on the wane, and then public unions, public sector unions started to develop. And now they are endemic. We have them for everything in the public sector. So we're going to probably have a couple of minutes more to talk about this topic when we come back from our break into our final segment. And so everyone, please stay with us. This is Radio Free Market. And I am your host, Michael McKay, and I'm talking with Dr. Walter Block, and with me, Mr. Aaron Brown. And we'll be talking with you in just a minute. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market. And so, Aaron Brown, I'm going to hand this over to you so we can cover as much as possible in this last segment. Go ahead.
Okay. So this, I think this is the most important issue at, you know, with relevance to today, the business cycle. You say, Walter, that it has its root cause in the Federal Reserve System. I really want you to spell out for our listeners how this occurs, because this is really very important, and how the, you know, this is not just a minor cause. The Federal Reserve is not a minor cause of the business cycle, but it's the capital P. It's the primary cause for the boom-bust cycle or business cycle. Could you explain that?
Yes. I don't want to denigrate the unions nor the minimum wage as a source of unemployment, but I think that in the modern day, perhaps even more important is what the Fed has done. Ron Paul has a book out, End the Fed, and as you know, he's now going to be chairman of the subcommittee that is going to override the Fed or regulate them or audit them, perhaps. What the Fed did is it artificially lowered interest rates practically down to zero. And what that does, according to Austrian business cycle theory of mainly Mises and Hayek and Rothbard, is it encourages, it subsidizes, in effect, entrepreneurs into making malinvestments, into investing in very long-term capital goods like houses and cars. We have housing, overabundance of housing, one because of Fannie and Freddie and HUD and the Boston Fed, which said that there was discriminatory mortgage practices. And another source of the overbuilding of housing is the low interest rate. The low interest rate encourages long-term roundabout processes more than short-term consumer products, direct consumer products, but long-term consumer products such as houses and cars. So we have a vast over-investment in this sector of the economy, and this creates unemployment because we just don't have the jobs there. The housing isn't needed. We have too much housing and therefore too little of other things. And given that the market is not perfectly flexible, the changes in employment from what the Fed has got us into to what we should be creates unemployment. So that's one source of unemployment. Another is a thing that Bob Higgs has called regime uncertainty. The Fed, the Obama administration keep changing things, and it's sort of like businessmen are like deer caught in the headlights. They just don't know what to do, and the last thing they're going to do is start hiring people. And another cause of the depression that we're now undergoing, and therefore the unemployment, similar to what happened with Roosevelt and the Smoot-Hawley tariff, we've got protectionism, which adds a further kibosh on the unemployment situation.
So if a government doesn't realize that the Federal Reserve causes the boom-bust cycle, then how can they claim to that any of their policies will solve it? They just don't seem to understand.
No, they don't understand because they haven't employed Austrian economists. They've got mainstream macroeconomists, the monetarists and the Keynesians. Well, the monetarists are Keynesians, but that's a whole other issue. The people in the Council of Economic Advisors and all these are very mainstream economists. Bernanke is a mainstream economist. They don't understand.
So, Walter, I'm going to interrupt you so you can get a quick answer in. The business cycle is a particularly relevant issue today. How do you think the boom-bust cycle problem can be corrected? We need a really quick 20-second answer.
Get rid of the Fed. That's even less than 20 seconds. Get rid of the Fed. Get rid of the Fed. Get rid of the Fed. And get rid of central planning of the monetary system. Get rid of the central bank. Get rid of the Fed. Go back to the gold standard. If we did these things, and elect Ron Paul to be president in 2012, or sooner if possible, let's impeach Ron Paul in there, and then we'll solve the unemployment problem.
All right, so we're going to have to end on that comment today. So thank you so much, Walter, for being with us today, and you too, Aaron. This is Michael McKay in Radio Free Market. Please visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com, where you can subscribe for free to all of our shows on iTunes or visit our Radio Free Market archives for easy downloads. And until next week, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom, and thank you for listening.